Yeah, I'm good on any MLK Boulevard. I'm good on any MLK Boulevard.
Kansas City, Missouri still doesn't have a street named after the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It was a year ago that the city council decided to rename Facile Boulevard after the iconic civil rights leader. The move kicked off a year-long controversy, resulting in a citywide referendum reversing that decision. I'm Michelle Tyrone Johnson. I cover race, identity, and culture for KCUR. So I've been reporting on the King Street controversy this past year. The night of the November election, I covered the watch party of a group that had advocated for the name to return to Facile Boulevard. In a 2-to-1 vote, they got their wish.
With 99% of the precincts reporting, we're at 70-30.
I also was born and raised here, so I know the complex attachments that people have to the street, once again known as Facile Boulevard. I have a theory that in America, cities often want to name something after King to look progressive about race as much as they do it to honor King. So I wanted to take a look at what King's name symbolizes when it's put on streets outside of the U.S. And with the grant from the Pulitzer Center, I got to do just that. As Kansas City went back to the drawing board, I set out on a quest to see how three different cities around the world have commemorated King with street names. My first visit was to Dakar, the capital of Senegal in West Africa. I'm a Black Midwesterner on my first trip to Africa, and I'm looking out at the most beautiful view of the Atlantic Ocean I've ever seen. The water is clear and sparkling with what looks like an endless sunny horizon. I've seen the ocean before, but there's something particularly moving about this view from this place. I picked Dakar for this journey because there weren't many African countries that had named a street after Martin Luther King Jr. And it seemed fitting that the westernmost tip of Africa, the closest point to America, would have one on its shoreline. There's just one thing. Most people in Dakar don't even know there's a street named after King. Even the taxi drivers. Most people here just use the old name of the street, Corniche, which is French for a road running along a coast. The two languages most people in Dakar speak are ones that I do not, French and Wolof. So Falou Touré is my cultural and linguistic lifeline during my visit. And even he's surprised to find out the official name of the street.
I was really so surprised at seeing that in Senegal that we got some street names after Martin Luther King.
Dakar is a city of more than 1 million people, and it moves at its own unique rhythm. I walk through the dry 80-degree weather, frequently treading sand blown in from the faraway Sahara Desert. In this mostly Muslim country, everyone knows who the Christian minister from Atlanta, Georgia was. Basarou Seck hand carves and paints wonderful wooden statues, which he sells in a cross between a storefront and an open stall. He doesn't know the place where he has set up shop is on King Boulevard, but he's happy to know now.
Martin Luther King, he's so inspirational to them because he saw them the way to be more courage, to trust in themselves and to be proud of, like, to be Black.
Falou and I also talked with Mom Dial Sene, who runs what we in America would consider a pop-up art gallery on the same street.
Among the things that she knows about Martin Luther King, and she's really so, grateful to him for what he done for, the Black African person.
Most of the people I'm talking to in Dakar mention how inspiring they found King's stand against discrimination, particularly discrimination against Black people. I visit Martin Luther King Middle School. It's an all-girls middle school with a good reputation for educational excellence. It's always hot here in Dakar, so the classrooms are big rooms with large windows facing each other with courtyards in between. Most of the girls are fascinated to meet a Black female American journalist, but are shy about talking to one. They know what they admire about King.
His determination and his courage.
Yasu Indie is a teacher here. He says King holds an important place in the African diaspora. He helped humanize Black people to others.
We see another facet, another side of what a black or an African could be. Because with his non-violent demonstrations, we see that the black isn't violent. He can even suffer.
Across town at another school in Dakar, I met Beatty Bokum, a teacher who organizes a Martin Luther King Day for his students each year.
When I was a kid at college, I read so many books about him, how he led the civil rights movement, and how he impacted by his nonviolent strategy of doing demonstrations. So I told my kids here that just get some values from him.
King had visited Ghana and Nigeria as several African countries were gaining independence from their colonizers. Senegal obtained its independence from the French 8 years to the day before King's assassination on April 4th, 1968. For some perspective on the many leaders that the people in Dakar revere, Falou takes me to the Park of Remembrance. It's an outdoor plaza right off the ocean with posters of African leaders like Nelson Mandela, and Senegal's first president, Leopold Sédar Senghor. It's here that I come across the first American voice I have heard in several days, Robert Lee, who is black and coincidentally from King's hometown in Atlanta.
It's just incredible that he's reached so far in so many places that you think you never would have gone and know his name has reached there. And that's the incredible thing about King and what his legacy is and what his legacy is for us.
He's delightfully surprised to see the poster of King and a few other black Americans such as Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, and President Barack Obama. While in Senegal, I have to visit Gori Island. It's famous for having the Door of No Return, the haunting view of the ocean that would have been the last site of home for enslaved Africans. On the ferry ride from the mainland, I'm finding it a little jarring that people laugh and play musical instruments. On the island, I meet Ilwa Koli, the chief curator of the House of Slaves. It's exactly what it sounds like. It was a compound for slaves before they were shipped off as chattel. And now, it's a tourist destination. Coley speaks of the impact of Martin Luther King's life and his death on Senegal and the rest of Africa.
That make Africans to make decision and to go deeper, to stand for, to fight against the violation of human rights.
Even separated by thousands of miles, Coley says that the life and work of black people in the U.S. are not unconnected to the lives of the people of Dakar.
The obligation is for us to link the two parts of our common story in order to rewrite our common history. That is a part of the history of human being.
In the land that many black Americans think of as the motherland, it's very clear to me that in Senegal, regardless of any street naming, Martin Luther King is as much a part of their history as any African-born leader. He's considered by many a favorite son. I think it's pretty obvious that one of my favorite things about visiting Dakar was the breathtaking view of the Atlantic Ocean. But I also found myself torn by what that beautiful ocean meant for the North Atlantic slave trade and what it meant for black people on my side of the ocean. So throughout today's show, I've asked Dr. Noelle Trent to provide some context. She's the Director of Interpretation, Collections, and Education for the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee. She talks about how West Africa has a history that would make it likely to want to honor Dr. King.
I think what's important about Senegal, particularly in its relationship to African Americans, is that Senegal is located on the west coast of Africa. And so it's one of the many places that enslaved individuals were taken from, right? So there's this long history there. But when we also look at the history of Senegal, when they acquired their independence from France, is in 1960. So in the midst of the civil rights movement, you see a lot of African countries, particularly West African countries, getting their independence from colonialism, right? And so Senegal has this very special relationship to the African diaspora, particularly here in the Western Hemisphere. And so I think people not being fully aware makes a little bit of sense, but the fact that there is even an MLK street in Dakar is a signal that they recognize the ties between the two countries, between these two populations. Their first president, Leopold Senghor, was one of the major activists in the African diaspora movement in the mid-20th century. He and Aimé César create this movement called Negritude, which is very similar to what we see in the Harlem Renaissance and later on in Black Power, that affirms blackness, that affirms your beauty, that affirms our culture, our traditional values in the wake of Eurocentric standards being pushed upon the Black population. And Senghor is very much a proponent of that. And so there's this long understanding and relationship between these two cultures. And so it makes a lot of sense that there would be an MLK Street in Dakar named after Dr. King. And that in another way, it makes sense that people may not know, because this is part of these memorialization things, right? That there for a time, there might have been a group of people who remembered and understood that. But as time goes on, if those ideas, if those areas are not brought to people's full attention, sometimes people take for granted those things and then they're not aware of those things. Keeping something alive in public memory is not just the act of memorializing something, it's the act of keeping that memory alive as well.
Which is why I found it interesting that in Dakar, again, just the way the streets and the community is organized is so different than what I think we Americans, particularly Midwesterners, are used to, right? We're Midwesterners, for example, are very used to the placement of signs. Like, I know at all times, I only have to walk probably a few hundred feet for me to see a sign that tells me exactly where I am. And in Dakar, it seems as if people moved in a more unified but informal way. Have you ever been to Africa?
I have not had the chance to visit the African continent. I have a lot of friends who are from various parts of the continent. And I think that's part of the cultural aspects of it. I think we all have to look at how we function in the geography around us. As Americans, as Westerners, we're very used to signage, right? Signage signals to us the neighborhoods. It gives us boundaries. It helps us understand where we are in relationship to others. It signifies spaces. And in other areas of the world, signage is not as significant. Signage can be seen as a sign of the colonizers. And so I think that when you see in Dakar that people just kind of know where streets are, or they use road marks or something like that to identify where they're going, I think that's part of the culture of things, right? And so sometimes when we go overseas, we're expecting the same standards that we see here in America. And I think that's just part of how people function. That's also the reason why it's a little bit harder for geographers to track MLK streets internationally, because the way that they name streets and how street naming functions in other countries is so different than in Western countries than it is in non-Western countries.
And it's so true. What I was impressed with was the efficiency, however, in how people got around, because I had to take taxi cabs a lot of times, and I had a translator with me, and Falu would tell someone where we were going, and without me being able to see any street signs or any even signal lights, I got from one place to another in a timely fashion. And I thought that was an interesting cultural way of operating that I liked. It was scary at some points in the taxi cab. It was right. A scary ride, but I liked that a society was so unified in its own way that it didn't need constant signs for people to know how to get from one place to another.
Well, you know, I think that also functions with the fact that we forget West African countries and cities have existed for centuries, right? Even before the colonists. So the way people move about their space is a reflection of the fact that that space has existed for generations, right? And so we take that for granted. And so some of what we're seeing is the efficiency of movement and how people move through the spaces. They are really inhabiting a practice that has lived in that area for hundreds of years, right? We don't have that in America as much, particularly different parts of the country. And so I think that it functions differently.
Well, also what I thought was pretty cool was that the prior street name for Martin Luther King Boulevard in Dakar is Corniche, which is how everybody referred to the street, because it's apparently French for on the cliff of a ocean or on the edge of an ocean, which I thought, okay, again, efficiency, that's what the street is. It is the street that's right off of the Atlantic Ocean, which was, again, as I said in my story, one of the most beautiful views I've ever seen. So that was another thing that I liked about it is, I mean, while King is the name of the street for purposes of the honoring, it's efficient to say Corniche because people would then know exactly where to go.
Yeah, and it would be interesting if you could trace what that street or what that road was called prior to the French. Now, that's about 300 years ago. But that labeling has meaning. It has significance. It's a signal to how people operated in the space. And that's really important as we look at the street naming issue, that it's not just about, you know, a name being taken away or a name being put upon something. It's also how it functions in the community and how people relate to it.
You said that about 300 years. So is that when the French colonized Senegal about 300 years ago?
Roughly, probably a little bit more than that, but yeah, about 300 years of French power. I mean, we have Europeans hitting the west coast of Africa as early as Prince Henry the Navigator. And so you have these European standards being put on things fairly early.
That's Noel Trent of the National Civil Rights Museum. In a few minutes, we'll visit my trip to the cooler climates 4,000 miles north of Dakar to Amsterdam. That's next on this special edition of KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyrone Johnson. Don't go away. This is a special edition of KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyrone Johnson. Late last year, I took a journey to three cities in three different parts of the world to see how they each honored Martin Luther King Jr. We just heard about Dakar and King's impact on Africa. My next stop was to the very different city of Amsterdam. I'm dodging bicyclists whizzing past me along the beautiful canals, and I'm immediately aware that, like my homegirl Dorothy, I am not in my home state of Kansas anymore, or in Missouri. I'm in Amsterdam. This small city in Netherlands might not come to mind when you hear the name Martin Luther King Jr., but he visited here just 1 year after his iconic I Had a Dream speech and just a few months before receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. He was here to give a speech to the European Baptist Federation.
Race is not the only issue which confronts our world, and Negroes are not the only Christians who are in need of justice.
King also gave a press conference at the very airport where I met with Kathleen Ferrier to discuss his influence on Amsterdam.
What we see all around the world is that politicians, governments, have difficulty discussing with the people. That is why people go out on the streets in Hong Kong, in Chile, all over. They feel not listened to. If there's one thing that Martin Luther King has been teaching us, is that we have to listen to each other and do not be afraid for the difficult questions.
In addition to being a professor and former member of parliament, Ferrier is the chair of the Dutch Martin Luther King lecture series.
We started with the lecture to keep the legacy and the thinking of Dr. Martin Luther King alive. And we are convinced that for our younger generations, but for our society, Dutch society in general, we need his thinking more than ever.
Ferrier says that King's relevance hasn't remotely diminished in the 52 years since his death.
What we see all around the world is that politicians, governments, have difficulty discussing with the people. That is why people go out on the streets in Hong Kong, in Chile, all over. They feel not listened to.
Amsterdam has a reputation for openness and tolerance, a rep built in part from having coffee houses where patrons can openly get weed to go with that caffeine. And even though it might be considered diverse, at least when it comes to racial diversity, I can't say that I see much. Additionally, the Netherlands is known for being a country dedicated to social justice. It's where the International Court of Justice at The Hague is located. During my visit, though, one issue people are talking about is blackface, used by a character named Black Piet in traditional Dutch Christmas celebrations. Also in the news, a Dutch soccer player of African descent left a game after being subjected to racist taunts. Kathleen Ferrier says these controversies make King's teachings more than just dusty history books to pull off a shelf.
What we do following the footsteps of Martin Luther King Jr. is to be brave and discuss the issues we have to discuss.
The influence of the slain civil rights leader can be seen in other parts of the Amsterdam metro area. I venture out to a small suburb very close to the city proper called Diemen. It's quaint. It reminds me of a Dutch prairie village. I'm here looking for the Martin Luther King Street plopped in the middle of a residential area. There aren't many people out, but I stop Marion Gortz as she's taking her granddaughter out for a walk. While she walks down King Street frequently, she doesn't know much about the street's namesake.
I really don't know. Give me a hint.
This is a first for me. Meeting an adult who doesn't immediately know exactly who King was and what he represents. But I have to remember that I couldn't name one Dutch human rights leader either. There's also a park in Amsterdam named after King in 1968, the year he was killed. The park hosts a popular festival each year and also has a small but stately statue of him created by Dutch artist Arco Caravan. 50 years after King's assassination, Caravan made and donated 50 identical statues of King to various institutions and individuals globally. It's a brisk and sunny day, and I have far better luck finding people here who could place King, like Raoul Jonker. He's a little bit sheepish that he doesn't know more about King, but honestly, while his details were a little off, it's impressive what this young Dutchman does know.
I had a dream. And a nice speech with, I don't know, 100,000 people in front of the Memorial Square of Lincoln Park. And I think he started sort of a revolution, but that's about it.
Sure, the number was closer to 250,000 and the place was Lincoln Memorial, but his facts are in the ballpark. Similarly, Vincent Groen has a general idea of the legacy he's surrounded by.
How do you say this in English? A forefighter of the rights, for equal rights, for whatever color you have. It sounds so blunt now, but you know exactly what I mean, I think.
Joan Berendesen is at the park walking her two dogs. She is an interesting take.
Martin Luther King, he was a president to the United States.
Berendesen immediately self-corrects.
He was an activist.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. 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 And why do you think?
Kind of president.
In his own way, he was a president.
Yeah.
Debbie Tankink teaches students with special needs. While I'm taking photos of King's statue, she comes over to talk to me as she keeps an eye on her kids. She's clearly proud that her city has honored King this way.
His message was so important still today for the world. I'm all for equality, and I think it's important that we fight racism and everything like that. So yes, I think it's great this park is named after him.
But as Kathleen Ferrier, the chair of the King Lecture Series, says, the name itself is just the start.
Why do we name a street, a boulevard, a park, or whatever after this person? What does he or she has to say to us? And that is why it's important. It keeps the name alive, and our concern is to see that it is not just the name, but also the thinking.
Amsterdam is a pristine modern city that attracts lots of tourists. It likes to honor history of all kinds in ways that feel more dispassionate than other places. But with the city park, a suburban street, and a lecture series, Amsterdam shows how extending the legacy of a leader is as much about intentional education as it is about passion. Dr. Noel Trent, a scholar and a historian, takes us through the particular history that Amsterdam would have with the legacy of King.
What's interesting about Amsterdam, what was interesting about your journey is that you went from Africa to Europe, and I don't know what your impressions would have been if you went from Europe to Africa, right? That has some influence on your perspective. But Amsterdam, like many European, the Netherlands, like many European countries, their economy and their modernization is very much done through slavery. The slave trade is not just the sale of human beings, it's property. When we think about the slave industrial complex, we have to think about all the things that make that function. So that's banking. You need someone to finance these companies. You need someone to insure your shipload. I mean, what happens if you get someone who has smallpox and smallpox infest your crew, right? That's kind of an issue, right? So there are cities and really countries in Europe that benefited greatly from the economic engine that the slave industrial complex facilitated. And Amsterdam is one of those places. Amsterdam has a huge banking industry, right? And so in some cases, they were very much directly involved with the trade. And in some areas, there's a little bit more indirect, but there are still very clear economic ties. So some of what you're seeing in Amsterdam is in relation to their legacy as colonizers.
It was hard to put my finger on it at the time. I mean, talking to you later helped. But even though people in Amsterdam were perfectly nice, there's a park in Amsterdam named after Martin Luther King. There's a street in a nearby suburb. There's a big lecture series. There was just a more chilliness, a more distant, more emotionally distant way, with the exception of one person I talked to. It was very different from Dakar, where Dakar people, there was almost an emotional component to them talking about King.
Well, for the Senegalese, Dr. King and the American Civil Rights Movement really does inspire their break from European colonialism, right? They take their inspiration from Rosa Parks. They take their inspiration from all of our actors, and they say, okay, we're going to secure our freedom. And because they have the benefit of having a nation state, they're able to break free from European control. You know, I think when we look at Amsterdam, the chilliness that you see is part of this complex legacy of race relations that exist in Europe and very much in the Dutch culture. There is a practice among the Dutch where they don't just celebrate Santa Claus, they celebrate Santa Claus's slave, who's responsible for bringing the gifts.
And if Black you look Pete. Around,
Black Pete and Zwarte Piet. And when you look in their holidays or whatever, you'll see folks dressed up in blackface. Now, as a person of African descent, we find that extremely insulting. But for them, that's part of their holiday rituals. And this goes back hundreds of years. And that's part of those complex race relations. Let's also not pretend that Amsterdam was also occupied by the Nazis. Where did Anne Frank hide? She had to hide in Amsterdam. So Amsterdam has this complex history of race, of anti-Semitism that they have to wrestle with. And so if you're expecting them to embrace Dr. King in the same way that the Senegalese secured their freedom and drew inspiration from, I don't think you're going to see that. Because they're very much still dealing with the legacies of enslavement.
Anne Frank was born the same year as Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes.
And so even in terms of placing them in the history of these countries, in terms of putting their lives on a timeline, I find that very interesting. Because I think so often in America, we forget how recently certain events happened.
Right. There's this meme that's floating around on social media right now that says, that has a photo of Dr. King, Anne Frank, and Barbara Walters. All of them are born in 1929, but we don't think of it that way, right? They all seem to experience similar things, but because of their backgrounds, their life experiences were very, very different.
I've posted that meme, so I know I'm very familiar with it. Yes.
Right. And we don't think of Barbara Walters per se as being that old. You know, she feels very much younger and very more present in our lives. And both Anne Frank and Dr. King feel very different. But all of them kind of come up. There's a period where they're all coexisting and they're experiencing the world at the same time. Right. And I think that bears some thought, right? We need to think about that. And then we need to think about how we reflect on them. Anne Frank, there's the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam that really keeps alive her legacy. But not only that, but what does fascism do? What does this sort of hatred perpetuate? And the fact that you also in that same city have a park dedicated to Dr. King, which forces us to reconcile what sort of hate can that perpetuate. At the same time, there are still these practices of Black people. There's still these practices of holding Blackness as other, right? Holding Blackness as being inferior, very much in the modern context. I think that, you know, I don't know if there's an answer to how that is dealt with, but I think it's just one of these things that we have to put together and say these exist in the same space.
And you know, that was the other thing that I found interesting about my trip to Amsterdam is I met, for the first time in my entire life, an adult who didn't know exactly who Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was. And that was, I mean, and I didn't hold that against the person because I couldn't, as I said in my story, I couldn't have named a Dutch human rights leader if, you know, my life depended on it. It's still an interesting concept for an American to know that not everybody places King as someone that they know about, even regardless of what their feelings are about them, that they know about him.
Right. And I think in some places, folks don't know about Dr. King. They're not aware of the African-American civil rights struggle. But when you can relate it to some things within their own culture, they begin to understand his impact and his significance. And I think that just signals a part of a broader conversation. I have been to Poland on a number of occasions, and a lot of Polish folks, some of them know about Dr. King, but they definitely know about their own solidarity movement. And like Walesa, who led the solidarity movement, when I talked to them about Dr. King and the American Civil Rights Movement and how that inspired their solidarity movement, they get it. They get the messaging. They get the significance. They understand the relationship between the two. So sometimes we have to do a little bit more work about spelling that out. But there's also something about being an American traveling abroad. You sometimes take for granted that not everyone knows your story. And we kind of feel like America's this international ambassador and everybody should know our stories. And the reality is that a lot of the world does not. And even when people kind of know who Dr. King is, they're not fully familiar with the broad scope of his legacy.
We're about to take a break right now. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyring Johnson. And when we return, it'll be from Memphis, the third and final leg of my quest to see how cities around the world have honored Dr. King. This is a special edition of KCUR Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyring Johnson, and as debates whirled around naming a street in KCMO after Martin Luther King Jr., I got all Carmen Sandiego with it to see how other cities pulled it off. If there was any American city I was going to visit for this story, it was going to be Memphis, the city where Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. It was also one of the last cities to formally name a street after him. That was in 2012. And that juxtaposition reflects the city itself, whether we're talking the blues from the famous Beale Street, or Sunday morning Southern hospitality.
Thank you.
Even the street naming in 2012 was complicated. Linden Avenue is a residential street that runs through a predominantly white neighborhood. I'm at the spot where it breaks off to become Dr. M.L. King Avenue. It's about a 1 mile stretch that has some industrial businesses, two colleges, and it ends downtown. That's where I meet longtime Memphis resident Lloyd McNeil, who says he thinks it's good to honor King's contributions.
He helped Memphis out a lot and straightened out, you know, segregation and, you know, and made everything better.
Mikey Thomas, who's younger, isn't as impressed.
I believe that, I mean, it's great to commemorate him. You know, his final place of living was here. So I do feel like it's a good thing that we have the street, but it doesn't really have much of an impact on the community or the city.
Thomas says Memphis is a city that likes to name streets after people. I'm noticing that. My hotel is on Elvis Presley Boulevard, not far away from the infamous Graceland. And while driving around the city, I travel down roads and highways named after B.B. King, Danny Thomas, Al Green, even the controversial Jerry Lee Lewis. Former Mayor A.C. Wharton says this is how Memphis honors people with a special connection to the city. Mayor Wharton was the second black elected mayor of Memphis and was in office in 2012 when the street was renamed.
We owed an obligation to Dr. King that was greater than any city may have owed him. Montgomery had its place. Birmingham had its place. But he didn't die in those cities. He was not martyred in those cities.
Wharton doesn't think there's any statement to make that Memphis waited so long compared to other American cities.
We have not denied our past. How can we? You don't have to put a scarlet letter on us to say that this was a place that was just filthy with hatred and racism, because it snuffed out the life of our leader. So we can't deny it, even if we wanted to.
Wharton says Memphis has just had to juggle a lot of problems over the years.
This city has been in a survival mode for so many years in terms of debt, crushing debt, state trying to take over and all. We really didn't have time to just kind of stick our head up and breathe.
Wharton says because of a receptive city council, the location of the street, and no attachment to the name, there wasn't a controversy over the street change. Additionally, Memphis has two parks named after King. There's also the National Civil Rights Museum, which is built around the Lorraine Hotel. And if you are of a certain age or have looked at enough history books, you've seen the picture of the Lorraine Hotel and the spot where Martin Luther King was assassinated on the balcony outside of his room. The museum is built around that. Noel Trent is a director at the museum. She was also the curator for the 2018 event that commemorated the 50th anniversary of King's death.
And it is controversial because, you know, he's still a very polarizing figure for a lot of people and the neighborhoods that people want to see them in.
Trent says even when the first street was named for Martin Luther King in Chicago, the year of his assassination, it was controversial. While talking with Trent, I'm struck by how she illuminates some of my observations that I couldn't quite get a handle on when visiting Dakar in Amsterdam. How in America, the decision to name a street after King has more complexity than it does in other places.
I think for many people, looking at renaming a street after Dr. King is a challenge, because then are you now committed to living out the principles, right? How are you maintaining that street? What is the messaging behind it?
It's been no different for Memphis.
This city is wrestling with the legacy of being the place where Dr. King was assassinated. That is a yoke that the city has wrestled with since hours after Dr. King was assassinated.
Trent also sees how the issues surrounding the renaming of streets after King intertwine with other tensions. She says the naming of a street in Kansas City after Martin Luther King isn't just about picking the right street.
We have to deal with the fact that the legacy of what's happening here traces back to dynamics surrounding race and racism that has existed in this area, this territory, literally since the founding of the state.
Trent has seen how the most biased of hearts can be impacted just by walking into the National Civil Rights Museum. So she believes street signs can be a subtle but significant start towards having people confront and heal some of their biases.
When you change the physical environment by putting up a statue, by putting a street in there, you are forcing someone to deal with that. And whether or not people can articulate that this is where their discomfort comes from, it's psychological.
Former Memphis Mayor A.C. Wharton says King's assassination was a tragic stain on the city, but it paved the road to the creation of the National Civil Rights Museum, a museum with about 360,000 visitors a year.
You never heard of a beautiful compost pile, but come spring of the year, it's that ugly compost pile that serves as a fertile soil for the reddest tomato, the brightest red rose.
Memphis is a vibrant but complicated city that since 1968 has had to deal with having King's assassination etched into its identity. And while they aren't proud of it, some residents say that street signs, parks, and even a national museum helped the tragic past lead to some greater good. Memphis is where I originally met Dr. Noelle Trent, and this hour, she's been providing some more context to the whole discussion of honoring his legacy and what it can mean to a community.
One of the dynamics that we see at play with the renaming of a street after Dr. King is, there's the race legacy, but there's also the economics of it. Not all businesses want to reprint business cards, rebrand their business as being on an MLK street. In more recent times, there's the belief that renaming a street after Dr. King will lower the property values. So there's different perceptions, and it's different streets, right? Not every street is a prominent street that's named after Dr. King. And sometimes people want to rename Main Street, and the community says absolutely not, or a major thoroughfare. And what happens is Dr. King Street is relegated to a place where the African-American community predominantly is, or a place off the beaten path. So it's not part of the overall infrastructure of the city. And that also says something about the placement of his legacy, right? If you put Dr. King's name on a major street, on a major thoroughfare, are you saying that you publicly endorse his legacy, endorse his work, endorse what it means? And when you cast it aside or put it in a very obscure part of town, great, you've done something, but it says that his legacy does not have as much value, right? And so it's not just the act of naming, it is also the location. And that's part of the dynamics that we see at play. We also have to recognize that not everybody likes Dr. King. As much as we have a national holiday dedicated to him, as many times as his I Have a Dream speech is played on all sorts of airwaves, people still do not like him, you know? And I think that has to do with a lot of what he preached, a lot of his action. He was a rabble rouser. He challenged the racial hegemony of this country. And, you know, some people still do not like to see that. And they don't want anything in reference to Dr. King in anywhere, any place in their community.
It's funny that you should say that, because I feel as if there are so many, I mean, and I was pleasantly surprised to see on Facebook on Monday, instead of a predominance of memes just saying the highlighted quotes from King, you know, like instead of seeing 50,000 versions of I Had a Dream, that mm-hmm. people were getting deep. People were reposting and commenting about the whitewashing of the King legacy, about how people are cherry picking the part of King's teachings. What do you think about that? And what part do you think that plays into the naming of things after him?
You know, I think that's a more recent trend. And, you know, I think I love it, because I think that people have distorted his legacy. They've distorted his words to what they were comfortable with. And I think there's a generation out there who's starting to study him and recognize he's more radical than you thought. There's more work coming out about that conversation. A lot more of us are saying, guess what? You quote him in 1963, but he was alive for 5 more years. How about we talk about what happens in those 5 years? Selma to Montgomery, Voting Rights Act, Poor People's Campaign. He's calling for a radical reimagination of how we treat poverty. He boldly says that poverty is not a crime. Hunger is not a crime. Being in those states, homelessness is not a crime. They are the product of systems that have disempowered people. And so rather than criminalizing the individuals who are suffering in those conditions, we need to criminalize the system that allows those things to be perpetuated. And in a country that spends millions of dollars on military defense, we should be reinvesting in our community. And that's, you know, that's a paraphrasing from one of his great quotes, because he said a country that spends more on its military defense than on the conditions of its people is approaching spiritual death. That's a powerful quote, but that's not part of the Dr. King that people celebrate, because people were uncomfortable with that. If you follow Bernice King's Twitter account, she has done a lot of work in the last few years at dispelling those myths just by her own words or quoting her father. I think over this past weekend, she says, "Don't quote my father's dream if you actively participate in voter suppression." And that was directed at very specific political officials. But she's saying you don't get to celebrate his legacy and call him a wonderful man while at the same time in your left hand, you're doing things to oppress people and to put people into poverty. So there's this dichotomy that's at work. And I think it's a signal that people are dissatisfied with how things are operating in this country, and they want to take a more critical look at his legacy so that they can then draw inspiration for moving things forward.
What do you think the big advantage to having a street named after King in Memphis has been? I know it's only been a few years, but just since 2012, but what do you think is the big advantage?
Well, you know, I think the Memphis MLK Street, first of all, it's downtown. It's near a lot of our downtown attractions. So it brings people, it connects people in a lot of different ways. It's located near historic Claiborne Temple, which is where the sanitation workers marched to City Hall. It's not too far from the National Civil Rights Museum. So it has a very, very prominent place. Now, about a couple of years ago, as we were approaching and preparing for MLK 50, local activist Tammy Sawyer, who's now one of our county commissioners, said, "Hey, look, you can't have media come down here and talk about Dr. King's legacy when right off of MLK streets, we got two Confederate statues. Something's got to be rectified here." And I think that helped facilitate that conversation of what became Take 'em Down 901. Right. You know, they were not too far from the Civil Rights Museum. They're not too far off of MLK Avenue. How is the city of Memphis in a public conscious way going to reconcile still celebrating these Confederate actors while also having these three places dedicated to the civil rights legacy? It caused something to be reconciled in public memory.
So for people listening who don't know what MLK 50 is, what was that event?
That was our 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. It was a very big event here in the city. We did it in April of 2018. And actually, we started it in April 2017. So it ran for 12 months and led by the National Civil Rights Museum, but also different community groups tapped into that as a way to commemorate Dr. King's legacy and look at ways to reflect and be motivated forward. So as we're doing that, as we're preparing to launch that, how can we also have in practice memorials dedicated to two men who were actively willing to suppress African Americans by wanting to keep them in slavery? You know, at some point you have to say, how does this coexist? And to be perfectly honest, the Confederate Sons of America were not pleased when the statues came down. And I think even that conversation has a lot to do with how we memorialize not only the Civil War, but what choices are made when we create these spaces of public memory and public dialogue. What has value? What doesn't have value? And it's still very controversial. People are still uncomfortable. There are folks who want things dedicated to civil rights activists that are coming up against opposition, who want to maintain statues, parks, street names dedicated to Confederate soldiers and generals. And all of those things exist in a very interesting duality. And many of those were not dedicated in the 19th century. They were created and dedicated in the 20th century as an opposition and an active suppression to what was happening in the civil rights movement. And so what we're seeing here in these public spaces is not just a fight over public memory. It's a fight over the continuing legacy of race in America.
That was Dr. Noel Trent of the National Civil Rights Museum. A very special thanks to Dr. Trent for helping me to navigate my trip to Three King Streets and for helping us to understand with more clarity how King's name on a street sign is less about the gesture of honoring his legacy and more about whether a community is manifesting it. This special edition of Central Standard was produced by Melody Rawl and me, Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Our editor was Sylvia Maria Gross. We also had help on this project from C.J. Janovi, Mike Russo, Chris Young, and the Pulitzer Center. Later today, the entire audio of today's show will be available at kcur.org/centralstandard. Find photos and more about my travels. Thanks for listening.